Thank you for joining us at the Roundtable.
Brought to you by Community Education Arts, a nonprofit organization based in Noblesville, Indiana.
I'm Alice Cavanaugh-Scober, President of CE Arts.
And I'm Sarah E. Morin, Secretary of CE Arts. Let's sit down
at the Roundtable.
Next, please welcome Sandy Stewart for the night Bobby came to the ball.
Sometime in the 60s, I was there, so I can't exactly remember. I visited a coffee house in Bloomington, Indiana, and fell madly in lust. Having felt like an alien being on the wrong planet for most of my life, I thought I had finally reached the mothership. The hippie movement wasn't just a fashion statement in those days, but a coming together and a rising up of dissatisfied, disillusioned youth raised under the threat of nuclear annihilation. We suspected that the duck and cover drills we had practiced would not protect us, since they were concocted and executed by the very adults who had fucked up our world. Never trust anyone over 30, we cried with one voice. To our great surprise, we eventually became 30, 40, 50, and so on, until live fast, die young, and leave a beautiful corpse was no longer an option. That ship has sailed. But then we were determined to undo our parents' mistakes, even though considerably hampered by the fact that approximately 50% of us could be drafted anytime to potentially die in a truly unholy war. We protested that war, burned draft cards, chased deferments, moved to Canada, harbored fugitives, and stuck flowers in gun barrels, determined to unite this fractured world in peace and love. Of course, we all know how that worked out. But it was a valiant, beautiful effort, gently executed by lovely flower children drifting along in a purple haze. This is the story of just such a haze. When I entered the coffee house that fateful 60s night, the performer on stage was everything I dreamed of and absolutely nothing I needed. He had scruffy long hair and beard, a mark of authenticity and true commitment as not everyone in the new movement had yet had time to sprout, and was playing his guitar Delta Blues bottleneck style while wailing a Sleepy John Estes lament about the dearth of deep sea diving women. Seems there were just none to be found. I'm a deep sea diving woman, I instantly decided. I went home with Mr. Delta Blues that night and married him 2 weeks later. I married him for two excellent reasons. One, because my parents threw him out of the house when I brought him home to Noblesville for a visit. And two, I had just broken an engagement to a very nice boy simply because I was restless and bored. So I thought that I should just dive headfirst into this one before the inevitable ennui set in. As the nice boy was the third young man I had planned to marry and didn't, I was beginning to think I might be too damaged and fickle to truly commit. So I just plunged in without pausing to check the depth. That worked out pretty much as you might imagine. But I learned a bunch of useful stuff. For example, just because a man sings about it doesn't mean he really wants a deep sea diving woman. A shallow woman that can tread water is more than enough for most, and a sassy drowning woman is way too much. I'm a little fuzzy on the details and timeline, but during the tumultuous year of our short marriage, Mr. Blues and I had left the Bloomington campus and ended up in New Albany, Indiana for a semester. I worked at the Census Bureau and took evening classes at the Indiana University Jeffersonville Extension. Shortly before I was to leave for my, this is, oh, this part takes place, I got the date on this when I looked it up, March 24th, 1968. Shortly before I was to leave for my anthropology class at IU's Jeffersonville campus, a Bloomington friend dropped by and passed around a truly epic joint. I'm still not entirely sure what the three of us smoked, but as soon as I got into my car and hit the interstate, I knew I should have declined. I still remember that the exit ramp to campus felt a bit like Alice's tumble down the rabbit hole. It seemed to spiral on forever. Fairly vivid flashbacks still occur from time to time when I'm on a curved ramp like that one. That night I was certain I would never reach the end. I know I prayed a lot. Just get me off this ramp and into my class and I'll never token drive again. I reached my class on time and I'm pleased to report that I have kept that promise, at least. That night, each step I took on the way to class was perilous, but I focused on the end goal. Just hold it together long enough to walk into the room and sit down at my desk. Prayer was involved with this journey as well. The floor was tilting and reeling, though I might have appeared nearly normal as I navigated the space, clutching other desks for balance until I reached my front row seat and heaved a great sigh of relief because I was safe for the next 2 hours and would likely come back to Earth by the end of the class. "Good evening," said the handsome young professor. "Robert Kennedy is speaking at the Youngstown Shopping Mall in Jeffersonville tonight." He then announced that the anthropology class that evening would be a field trip to hear the great man speak. As I tried to absorb this news while grappling with the fact that I might have to leave my safe seat and manage to walk erect, he said, "Raise your hand if you drove here tonight." You would think I would have kept still, but you would be wrong. I fought through the fog and raised my hand. "I have a car," is what I think I said.
"Car."
The professor then organized a carpool by dividing class members and assigning each to a vehicle, all except mine. Starting to feel a little relief, I heard my professor say, "I'll ride with you." You know how Mark felt when he was holding the cement block? Once we reached the car, I managed to start it and shifted into gear and began to drive. My professor shifted as well and placed his hand on my leg. Gobsmacked and dumbstruck for a moment, I finally bleated, "I'm married." And that's all I remember until we reached the mall. I sort of heard the great men speak, and history records that it was a great speech, addressing serious issues important to me at the time, such as Vietnam and civil rights. Sadly, the only thing I remember was Bobby saying we should vote for him because he had a lot of children to support and needed the job. That snapped me out of my stupor. I was furious. How dare he joke when our world was in shambles? Did I mention that I took myself quite seriously in those days? I didn't think our perilous future was any laughing matter. Sadly, I had no capacity then to appreciate the kind of man who could make jokes and continue the struggle after having survived the hellish loss of his beloved brother. Now I'm amazed at his strength. How could he keep fighting? How could he laugh and carry on? Why didn't he tell us the truth about why he wanted to be our next president? My heart was bleeding and I wanted truth. Of course, he may have done so, and brilliantly. He may have soothed all our bleeding hearts. I dismissed it because I was stoned. Maybe that's the night Bobby declared, "Some men see great things as they are and say, why? I dream of things that never were and say, why not?" I know that this great man managed to quell a potential riot and calm an angry, grieving crowd in Indianapolis just 11 days later when Dr. King was assassinated. How did he muster the strength, wisdom, and determination to carry on? Because he truly was a great man, and I missed appreciating him because I was a foolish little girl. By the way, I encountered the handsome young professor a year or so later at a love-in on the Bloomington campus. Bobby was dead, and my first choice for president, Eugene McCarthy, had lost heart and dropped out of the race. My world had darkened considerably, but I was single again. Who saw that coming? The professor was looking a little shopworn, neither as young nor as handsome as I remembered. We hugged, danced a little, and then I floated far, far away to the Isle of Manhattan, where I encountered unlimited opportunities to practice deep sea diving, with the occasional drowning and resuscitation. Eventually, I washed ashore in Noblesville, where I found a genuine, bona fide, deep sea diving, guitar picking man. Turns out he was here all along.
Deliver your phone.
Now, hopefully the guitar is still relatively in tune. Started not too long ago, and it's called the Indie Song Name Game. And they give you a prompt, and then you have a week to write a song about it and post it online. So I think this was the very first one, and the prompt was Garage Sale. So this is my take on that prompt. It's called Garage Sale Blues. Garage sale blues, I got garage sale blues. My wife just sold my bowling shoes. Got the damn garage sale blues. Well, the yearly garage sale happened today, and I ain't got a lot of good things to say. I got the mean old neighborhood garage sale blues. Well, she sold my shit for pennies on the dollar, and when I found out, y'all have heard me holler. Got the cleaning out the house again garage sale blues. Well, she sold my vinyl albums, even the doubles. If she sold them to a cop, I'm probably in trouble. Got the 1970s marijuana smoking blues. Double albums were the thing for separating your weed, and I reckon that a few of mine were still full of seeds. Got the paranoid homegrown Indiana ditch weed blues. Garage sale blues, I got garage sale blues. Somebody bought my old game of clues. Got the damn garage sale blues. Well, our stuff cost over $1,000, but we only made $100 back, and I think it sucks. I got the buy high, sell low, bad investment blues. This chairs marked a quarter, will you take a dime? These people want to dicker with you every time. Got the bargain hunter, low budget, redneck shopper blue. Well, a carload of kids I ain't ever seen come a costume shopping for Halloween. Got the retro wardrobe, outdated fashion blues. Well, they stood in my driveway looking and laughing, and it made me so mad I wanted just to smack them. Got the old guy out of touch, cargo pants wearing blues. Garage sale blues, I got garage sale blues. I just can't win, I'm born to lose. Got the damn garage sale blues. If you've ever been there, you know it's true. You got the damn garage sale blues.
Start a file and all that stuff, and I don't really read anything. I just start a file, and then I start reading things after things have come in. And the first time I read this poem, I had to stop and just go away and think about it. And so I asked her specifically if she would read it for us tonight. So, Holy Morning. I love you. I wake before my alarm. God shook my shoulder. I don a pilgrim's hood, my gray sweatshirt. He calls me outside, into the monochrome edge of the day, just before dawn opens her eyes. The world catches and holds her breath. I exhale incense into the chilly air. My dew-baptized feet dance to bring forth the sun. My pleading fingers split the rays, comb them through my hair. Supplicant and celebrant, I plow my prayers into deep rows of earth. The fields, my spacious sanctuary. The birds, my chorus of praise. The sky, a high vaulted cathedral, refracting stained glass light. The golden stubble of corn stalks form an amber mosaic of resurrection. My soul is a universe, expanding ever faster across my ancestors' farmland. Stretch out to embrace everything that is, everything the light touches. This morning, before I am small again, I am made holy. Nothing can contain me. I taste infinite God.
Yeah, I had to sit with that one for a while. Our last presentation tonight is our Award of Merit winner, The Name Game, by Vanita Cox Searle. And I'm not going to say anything else about it. It speaks for itself. So come and give it to us.
I was going to try to say something clever like everybody else. I'm a bit overwhelmed by all this, so.
We love you.
Okay, can you hear me? Okay. The Name Game.
Perfect.
I press my face against the chill glass of the picture window in my grandparents' living room, watching the occasional car crunch along the road, tire chains pressing their patterns into the snow. The snow covering our front yard was bright enough for sunglasses. Not that anyone in my grandparents' house had owned something so frivolous as sunglasses, no sir, Bob. All the young movie stars like Elizabeth Taylor or Audrey Hepburn wore sunglasses. I longed to be out in that brightness and stomp around, build a fort, maybe engage in a snowball fight or two. I wanted to run and laugh. I just had to spin around with my arms straight out from my sides through the cold, snappy air. No school today, no fourth grades up and downs. Grandpa was on day shift, so the day promised to be a good one. My grandmother's voice called me to come eat some breakfast. I walked into the kitchen as slowly as I could. My mother sat at the dinette, her upper body rocking slowly back and forth, her eyes looking at nothing. She was a small woman with dreary brown hair caught in several places by little girl plastic barrettes, my barrettes. "Morning," I said, as I pulled out a chair across from her. I knew that being as cheery as possible with grown-ups sometimes worked wonders. I looked at her carefully as she walked a little faster. She had been biting her lips again. I could tell by the thick scabs on her mouth. I poured some Twix into my Mickey Mouse Club bowl, wondering what I could do to get some kind of response from her. "Silly rabbit, Twix are for kids." I wiggled the cereal box up and down in front of her. No response. "She's not feeling well," Grandma said, as she moved around the table to the sink. According to her, either my mother wasn't feeling well, or she was doing so much better. She said this mostly on the telephone, or on the rare occasions she went to church with Grandpa and me. "I'm fine." My mother sounded like a ghost. Her voice always seemed to come from a distant place that I couldn't see and would never find. Her hands began to shake. "Jerry," Grandma said, "eat something. You need to build up your strength." "No, thank you." "Isn't the snow pretty?" I asked. "I sure would like to play out in that snow, wouldn't you?" "Don't be silly," Grandma said. "It's too cold." She turned on the hot water and poured a little ivory liquid into the sink. I thought I heard a small sigh underneath the sound of the water, but I may have been mistaken. I watched my mother for a few minutes more. Should I keep trying to get her attention? Sometimes I could make her laugh. Her laughter was like Tinkerbell and wind chimes all rolled into one. I lived to hear that laugh. If I pressed her too hard, though, she would wind up tight and start acting like a feral cat. No way to touch one of those. I longed for her to be like the other moms in the neighborhood. Those mothers looked their children in the eye. They touched them, fed them, called them by name. I had a hard time remembering my mother saying my name, and I couldn't address her by any name at all without her becoming upset. "Jerry," Grandma said, "eat something." Again, no. She got up from her chair and left the kitchen. I knew she was going to our shared bedroom. I just hoped she didn't lock the door this time. I finished my breakfast and began my campaign to get out into that waiting snow. I knew Grandma didn't like me to do anything extreme, and playing in 0-degree weather counted as extreme. I begged and begged and begged until my grandmother threw her hands in the air and said, "Your nose will freeze up and break off if you go out there, but if that's what you want." She encased me in a couple of sweaters, a pair of corduroy pants, and a snowsuit. She put gloves on my hands and mittens over the gloves. Then she ran my double socks-covered feet into some snow boots. She put a bright cherry red woolen hat on my head and wove a matching scarf around my neck. Both were birthday gifts from my father. He lived with my brother in the next state over, and that hat and scarf set was my favorite present. "There," she said, "you'll be back in 5 minutes. Mark my words." I was always having to mark Grandma's words since I had such a flighty nature. She scooted me out the door. The frigid air smacked against my cheeks. Praise the Lord, I thought, as I squinted against the morning light. No one else was outside. If I stomped a fox and geese pattern in the snow, surely someone would see me and come out to play. I ran around in a big circle several times to pack the snow down just right. Then I twirled in the middle of the circle to make a small round place where a goose could be safe. Finally, I made the spokes from the center to the outer circle for the best game of tag in the whole wide world. I looked around to see if anyone had taken the bait. Not a child in sight. No dogs or cats either. I ran around and around the circle to keep warm. I didn't want to go back into that house defeated. I wouldn't hear the end of it for the rest of the day. Grandma would call each of my aunts and tell them that I insisted on getting my own way again, and how I was sure to come down with pneumonia, and how hard it was to raise a child at her age, and what an ungrateful girl I was, and then she would tell me the same thing. I didn't need the reminder. I heard a storm bank door bang and turned to plead with Grandma for just a few minutes more. My mother hovered on the front stoop, looking like Casper the Friendly Ghost. She wore a dingy white coat, no hat, no scarf, no mittens. How did she get away with that? My grandmother's face appeared briefly in the picture window, then disappeared. "I want to play too," my mother said. "Sure." I wanted to throw my arms around her and hug her hard, but I just ran up to her and tapped her on the back. "Here, Fox." I dashed onto the game path so excited that I tripped over my own feet and smacked face first into the snow. I got back up as quickly as I could and I felt a thump on my shoulder. My mother's laugh danced through the crisp cold air. "One for me," she said. "My turn for Fox." I chased her up and down the spokes until I caught her around the waist. "Please," I looked up at her, "please, may I call you Mom?" She pulled out of my grasp and bent over, gasping for air. "You may call me Jerry," she said. "All my friends call me Jerry." And she took off around the path again. She'd mixed up her turn, but I didn't care. "Jerry," I called out just so I could say her name out loud. "Silly goose, look out for the fox." I must have called her Jerry 10 times that morning. "You're fun, Jerry. Gotcha, Jerry. Jerry this and Jerry that," until I was dizzy with joy and so full of hope that I could just burst with the fullness of it. She dashed and weaved around that game path like she was a kid, her eyes bright with happiness. To me, she looked like she had a reason to be on this earth, and I wondered at it. I wished that she would look that way when she saw me enter a room. The screen door creaked again after what seemed like just a minute or two, and Grandma let us know. Hot cocoa and donuts were waiting inside, and that was a good thing, too. My nose was so frozen, I thought it was going to shatter. Not that I would admit it. I bounced through the door after Jerry and whispered to Grandma as I moved past her. She said I could call her Jerry. She really did. "Well, now," Grandma said. That's what she usually said when she didn't want to commit herself. "Let's get you both warmed up and dry." We slurped cocoa and munched donuts at the kitchen table like old chums, Jerry and me, as I chatted away about what we could do after lunch. Maybe play with my dolls, or a game or two of Monopoly. Or, I tried to be nonchalant, "Maybe you could read me a book." I watched as the light in my mother's eyes dimmed like a cloud-covered moon, and her body began to rock. "No, thank you," she said. "I'd gone too far." I went to her before she had time to get out of her chair. I wrapped my arms around her shoulders and kissed the top of her head. Her body stilled until I let her go. "Never mind," I said to her retreating back. "Perhaps another day."
That's our award of merit. Thank you, Bonnie. That was beautiful.
Well,
yes,
that's it. A few closing comments. You are encouraged to buy books. We do have the credit card option going. Okay, can you wave your hand right there? Miss Spike, you can do the credit card option. And we do have some more food. So thank you so much for coming tonight. Oh, and the surveys go in the basket if you fill one out. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
This has been At the Roundtable with Alice
and Sarah E.
of Community Education Arts.
Our nonprofit organization is based in Noblesville, Indiana. You can find us online at cearts.org.
This activity made possible in part with support from the Indiana Arts Commission and the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency.
We'd like to thank James Weston for writing our intro music and for his technical savvy.
Join us next time
at the Roundtable.